A recent summit in Washington, D.C. involving some of the world's leading experts in the arena of genetics was called to discuss what used to be the stuff of science fiction, gene editing.
Today, new technology to edit genes is here, and for those who know what they're doing, it's easy to use. Gene editing is the process of removing maybe a portion of genetic code, maybe something linked with a disease risk, replacing it with a more desirable, less diseasy code. While the technology is there, the ethical questions, though, have yet to be sorted out. Some scientists say it could help do everything from cutting our cancer risk to curing fatal disorders before they happen. Others worry it could lead to a society of genetic haves and have-nots.
Our Alta Charo is with us now. She's a professor of law and bioethics at UW-Madison, and she's the co-chair of a new committee studying the implications of gene editing for the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. She recently attended that gene editing summit in Washington. Alta, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Well, let's start with the basic. Can you describe, from your perspective, what gene editing is?
Gene editing is a technology that allows very precise changes in the DNA sequences that are in all of our genes. So rather than trying to insert an entirely new gene, which is currently one of the things we do with gene therapy efforts, here you have the opportunity to snip out just the portion of the sequence that is malfunctioning and substitute a functional sequence instead. A functional sequence that's already found in human beings or in animals, whatever kind of organism you're working with. It's why it's called editing. It's more like what we do when we do a spell check on our documents rather than substituting whole words.
And so for people who know what they're doing, scientists, geneticists, how easy is this to do today?
Remarkably easy. This is one of the reasons why the technology has taken off so quickly. It's only a few years ago that the first papers came out explaining how to do this with this level of precision and ease from laboratories at Harvard MIT by Feng Zhang and at Berkeley by Jennifer Doudna. And within just a couple of years, laboratories all across the country began using this technique for a variety of experiments, including experiments just to create some particular genetic sequence they need in their laboratory for further experiments, not to change animals or people or plants or anything like that. We also have people here at UW that are using this technology today.
And there's something kind of new, a new technology called, I'm going to use the acronym, but it's CRISPR-Cas9. What is that?
That is gene editing. So CRISPR, which stands for, now I'm going to have to remember if I can actually get it, I'm so used to the acronym, Cluster Random Intersection. First, poly something or other. See, even I can't remember.
we'll just call it CRISPR, shall we?
Yes, we'll just say CRISPR. And Cas9 is just the first version of this, the first combination of entities you needed to do. But in fact, already in the last 6 months, we've seen papers come out using things other than Cas9. So without getting into the technicalities, let's just say that there are variations on this technique, and each one seems to be making it easier or more precise for different purposes.
Now, if we're talking about blue sky science, the sky's the limit, what are some of the possibilities for this technology, both in the near practical arena and the far-off arena as well?
Well, one of the first areas of interest really is in creating laboratory tools and diagnostic tests. And that's probably going to be where we see the first glimmerings of this technology coming to fruition. Next, we certainly can expect to see agricultural applications in the areas of engineering plants and animals. We do engineer plants and animals already. We do it through techniques that are less efficient or less economical or even less precise. And so I would expect there be interest here for making plants more pest-resistant or more drought-resistant, more heat-resistant, all of which may be very valuable in light of climate change. We also have the possibility of having plants that will, excuse me, have different nutrient qualities, like we now do with golden rice. And for animals, there are people already using older technologies to make animals essentially into pharmaceutical manufacturing sites. There's a goat that's been used for years, whose milk excretes a pharmaceutical substance. And in just today, the Food and Drug Administration approved an engineered chicken whose eggs also are able to produce a pharmaceutical substance that can then be purified and used for therapy. And of course, you could also engineer animals to make them better models for human disease. So you could engineer a pig so that its heart, which is already very close to the human heart and is used for medical research, you could engineer the pig so that it's even closer to human.
Briefly, what about people?
Well, see, I was running up to that, but, you know, one of the reasons I took all this time is because, in fact, the engineering, the use of editing for people is something that's not going to happen anytime soon, right? There's two kinds of things you might do with people. By far, the most interesting and important one is in what we would call somatic cell therapy. So, for example, you could change the sequences in the cells that are in the bone marrow for somebody who's got leukemia and therefore produce healthy cells that might cure or at least cause the leukemia to slow down in its progression. And there's been one experiment already that has hinted at the possible successes in those areas. Or to change the cells in tumors when we're talking about people with cancer. So a lot of these therapies that are just directed at the tissues of the body, those all go through very lengthy reviews before they ever make it into clinical application. The FDA regulates them through many, many layers of testing for safety as well as effectiveness. The second area, the one that is even further down the road and we're going down a kind of spectrum of likelihood, is so-called germline editing. That's where you're going to change the sequences in eggs and sperm or embryos. When you do that, the resulting offspring will have the changed sequence, which may mean, for example, a sequence that no longer codes for a lethal disease. It also means, though, that that offspring, that child, will have this changed sequence in their own eggs or sperm, so their children will have the changed sequence and their grandchildren and great-grandchildren. So germline is one that is a change that would go reverberating down the generations.
We're talking right now with UW-Madison law professor and bioethicist Alta Shero. She's the co-chair of a new committee studying the implications of gene editing for the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. We're talking about a recent summit taking up the ethical questions around genetic engineering.
And we want to hear from you. Do you think gene editing should move forward? Do you have questions, thoughts, hopes, or fears when it comes to gene editing for plants, for livestock, maybe someday for people? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with UW-Madison law professor and bioethicist Alta Shero. She's the co-chair of a new committee studying the implications of gene editing for the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. And we're talking about a recent summit taking up the ethical questions that surround the science of gene editing.
And we want to hear from you. What do you make of the ethical questions surrounding gene editing? Are you worried it could lead to a society of genetic haves and have-nots if and when someday it's used for humans? Or is it maybe a solution to serious health problems for people who carry genetic disorders? Call in with your questions, your thoughts at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
So, Alta, the summit that you were recently attending in Washington, D.C., it seems an effort of scientists to get ahead of this technology, which is moving very quickly, and answer some of the big ethical questions, and there are many that surround this. So what are some of the big questions that scientists are asking right now?
And just to be comprehensive, it wasn't just scientists. People at the summit from all over the world included sociologists, anthropologists, lawyers, as well as people from the clinical and basic research community. So, yes, they are trying to answer questions, and some of them you've even alluded to already. If we were able to move this into actual medical practice, how do we make sure that this technology is available to all people? That's a problem that's embedded in a larger issue around access to healthcare in our healthcare system. The other thing that people talked about very often is how to control the use. That is, there may be areas where there's wide consensus that a valuable use might be to treat a disease or to reverse a disease, but there's usually some level of concern about it being used for more frivolous purposes or at least less noble purposes. The so-called enhancement debate about trying to change our qualities in ways that are somehow different and better than what you'd ordinarily expect in a human. Again, something we see every time people use vitamins or do exercise, but the concern always here is that somehow it is beyond our own personal effort and is somehow undeserved and more problematic. There are also questions about how we regulate it all, because we can regulate for one purpose, but once the technology is out in clinical use, there are many degrees of freedom for physicians and patients to access it for other purposes that may not have been proven to be safe and effective. You know, it's a shiny new object, and we've seen with stem cell therapy that even while the reputable work is still going on in clinical trials, we have clinics advertising so-called cures that patients flock to because they misunderstand the state of the science and the maturity of the field. All of those things were being discussed. And there was a fair amount of consensus around the need to make sure that we could direct this technology toward the most important and most valuable uses.
Now, one thing you alluded to earlier is the fact that once you make this gene edit, it is passed on to all subsequent offspring. If that were not the case, if this were something that just stayed within the one person, the one animal, whatever you're working with, what questions would change?
Well, first of all, let me just reiterate that the so-called germline or transgenerational change is not only not done now, but in humans, that is, but it is the furthest out in terms of likelihood and number of people that could possibly have some real need for it. So let's keep in mind that that one is the one that is the least likely to be seen anytime soon. But sure, if we don't have transgenerational change, a lot of things are changed. For example, we usually decide if new medical technologies are appropriate by looking at the risks that they pose and the benefits that we hope they'll offer. Now, if the risks are confined to a single person, that's a much smaller spectrum of risk than if it's one that could reverberate down generations of people. So the confidence we have that the possible benefit is reasonable in relation to the risk is going to increase considerably. You also have the added value of having the person who's going to experience this change, the cancer patient, for example, whose tumor is going to be treated, being there and able to make decisions about whether to try out what will, for a long time, still be a new and not yet completely proven technology. With transgenerational change, you have people in the future who will, of course, not have had any say in whether or not they are going to be the recipients of these changes. So again, if you have a single generation, you have a somatic cell therapy, that is, a lot of things become simpler and much more familiar to our usual standards for how we go about this.
And Alta, just briefly, before we let you go, does there have to be consensus on this before anything changes, before the science moves forward?
Well, yes and no. So no in the sense that we generally approve things based upon their technical aspects. You know, what do we know about the risks they pose for human health, for animal health, for environmental effects, and what are the possible benefits to the individual or to society? Yes, though, in the sense that some of the applications are going to be things that need some public input, so we decide how important they are. How important is it that you can have a cure for your cancer in light of the risks of the technology? Or if we were, in fact, talking about germline, how important is it that you have the option of having a genetically related child who's at no or low risk of this disease you dread, as opposed to using adoption or some other mechanism for having a family that doesn't involve this kind of new technology?
And we leave it there. Alta, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Alta Sharrow is a professor of law and bioethics at UW-Madison. She joined us to talk about the ethical questions surrounding the growing technology of gene editing.